This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. 20 years ago, Atlantic City was the place to be on the East Coast for the potent combination of gambling, shows, and nightlife. Jobs in the casinos were plentiful, and many of them were full-time and paid well with good benefits. Well, most of us know the story by now. Legalized gambling has taken off throughout the Northeast. The market is saturated, and Atlantic City has once again fallen on hard times. What has happened to the jobs and, importantly, to the people who worked and still work in the casinos? Our guests this hour have co-authored a book called Just One More Hand, Life in the Casino Economy. Deborah Feigart is a professor of education and economics at Stockton University. Welcome, Deb.
Thank you very much, Mary.
And Ellen Mutari is a professor of economics also at Stockton University.
And it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. So, as we know, 4 Atlantic City casinos closed last year. And the book opens with a job fair at the Golden Nugget. This was February of 2014. 1,300 people vying for 50 positions. Tell the story.
Well, there was advertised to be this job fair that Golden Nugget was anticipating had seen an uptick in their revenues, and that they thought that they would be hiring people for a variety of positions. And people just showed up in droves. The lines, the newspaper covered the fact that the lines wrapped around from one floor down to the next floor. But what happened when people got there was that the corporate ownership, which was removed from Atlantic City, sent notice that, no, we don't think there is enough of an uptick in order to hire in Atlantic City. So instead, this job fair is going to be for jobs in Louisiana at a new casino that we're building. And we were just really struck with that story, although we were already deep into studying this topic. All these people who were having their hearts broken and basically being told that they had to uproot themselves from their community and their families if they wanted to continue working in this industry.
What is the hiring situation like now in Atlantic City?
Well, there are about 8,000 workers that have lost their jobs in the last year, and some of them have found jobs in other casinos on the same boardwalk strip or in the Marina District. Some have found jobs in casinos in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania and Maryland, but a lot have held on, waiting for Atlantic City to redevelop for something in the future because they have skills and they have communities, as Ellen said, and families there, and their children are in the schools there. So they are looking forward to a better future.
Let's talk about the glimmer of hope that was reported last week, and we'll talk about how real it is. There was news that Atlantic City's remaining 8 casinos saw their revenue up just under 2.5% in March as compared to March of 2014. What does this mean?
That is a glimmer of hope. And basically what it means is if you look at the overall pie and the overall numbers, the casinos that are left standing are having more revenue and more gross operating profits. But year to year, total revenue and total profit is down compared to where it was years ago. So the pie overall in gaming is still shrinking in Atlantic City because of competition in the Northeast.
In
2006 was really the peak of gaming revenue in Atlantic City. The number of jobs actually peaked quite a bit earlier in the late 1990s, about 1998. So we've been seeing a slow decline in the number of jobs even long before these major layoffs last year.
And the type of jobs, the jobs that were full-time, that offered great benefits, that's changed significantly over the last 20 years.
Yes, and that was one of the 3 promises of the casino gaming industry. When the number of the people we spoke with in the book, for example, we spoke to Zoe, a cocktail server, who with her whole family filled out applications when the casinos opened. Her family had worked very hard, they were Atlantic City residents, to bring the casinos to Atlantic City. And for years, people told us that, yes, these were good jobs, particularly for people who just graduated from high school. Our country has had a lot of trouble since we've seen a lot of the outsourcing of manufacturing jobs, providing jobs for people who don't go to college. So people felt that they could support their families, that they had benefits even when they went back to part-time work, for example, if they had young children. So overall, there were a lot of ways in which these jobs provided sustainable livelihoods. However, in recent years, with the saturation in the market, with the cost pressures on the casinos, we see a shift towards part-time work. And that's not unique to the casinos.
Sure.
And that's a trend that we see not only throughout the United States, but throughout the world, this growth in the precariousness of jobs. But what we found was that more recent employees were juggling multiple part-time jobs and hoping for more hours in the summer when the casinos are busier than in the off-season, trying to income package between a variety of different jobs. They've seen cutbacks in their benefits and a whole variety of things that are making it much harder to provide.
Like many Americans, their health care is more costly. They've noticed cuts in the services for employees in the cafeteria. Even the cafeteria food has gone downhill. Hmm. One of them talked about, they took away my A1 sauce and I get up at 3:00 in the morning to report to work. And I don't want the same old thing for breakfast all the time.
Let's roll the clock back a bit and go back to the late 70s when Atlantic City, you know, because gaming was okayed and Atlantic City began to develop its casinos. You interviewed 35 people for this book, and a number of them were day oneers, including mm-hmm. a woman that you call Sue B., you know, not her real name. Tell us about her. She was a high school graduate who she goes to the Golden Nugget trying to find work as a dealer. Deb?
She tried several times to find work as a dealer, and she said she's really smart, and she has a lot of skills, and she went to dealer school, and she said, I know I can do this job. And she convinced management to hire her, and they are glad they did, because those were the days she worked for Wynn.
Yes, she Wynn worked was at the original
owner,
Golden Nugget.
The original Golden Nugget. And Wynn was a good manager, and she worked her way up from dealing cards all the way up to pit boss. And she had a good time, and selling the experience of entertainment is actually very hard work, harder than it looks. So you build these regular relationships with your customers. They come back and see you. You have these coworkers that you work with, and you're trying to have a good time. And it was the life of the party back then. It was really good times back then.
She tells a story about how Steve Wynn gave his management staff,
everyone got a car.
Yeah.
She said she'd never had a new car before. And she kept that car for a long time. And she said it was just the generosity that she felt. She felt respected by her managers. She felt valued. They had parties for staff. And since this was shift work, in which so that people were coming and going at different shifts, the parties would go on for hours. And she said they had shrimp as large as your hand. Mm. And they would just keep replenishing the bowls. It was just such generousness that she felt she had never seen before from an employer. And she had bounced around. She came from Bucks County, actually, in Pennsylvania. She had bounced around from job to job to job before she settled there.
So what she did say that there were very, very good times, but it's also really hard work. It's hard on your family. It's hard to balance work and family, and it's hard on your health because of the smoke.
Well, let's roll back a minute. Hard on your family. How so? Full-time job with benefits.
It's a full-time job with benefits, which is the good thing. The bad thing is you are working the late shift or the grave shift. You are reporting to work late in the afternoon or the dinner hour. You're working through the night. And you are working Friday and Saturday nights, which is the busy period in the casino industry. So family barbecues are out. Family reunions are out. Trying to see your spouse is very difficult. Trying to get your children home from school or off to school is very difficult. It really takes its toll on families. And look, as someone told to us who works in the industry, who married in the industry, my father always told me that if you're a manager at McDonald's, you're going to marry the manager at Burger King. And there's a lot of, shall we say, intermarriages in the industry.
Sure.
And people trying to make it in this one industry.
And the smoke.
And the smoke.
It is part of the gaming life.
It is. And one of the interesting things that we found was that that was particularly hard on female workers in the industry. And there are a lot of jobs that tend to be female dominated. Dealers are fairly evenly split, but there are cocktail servers out on the floor and so forth. So that was particularly hard for women when they got pregnant, because you, in a sense, the smoke created a a lack of attachment to their jobs. Mm. So people would drop out of their jobs when they got pregnant, and in the old days when there were plenty of jobs and they could get back in. But the smoke also, we spoke with people who said their doctors would listen to their lungs and say, "Are you a smoker?" And they'd say no. And they said, "Well, you must work in the casinos then," because they had the lungs of smokers.
And yet they stayed.
And yet they stayed, because these were this was the dominant industry in the area.
And they built these, they had such pride in their work, and they're so good at it, dealing with people and dealing with millions of dollars that cross the casino floor. And they're dealing with people who bet tens and thousands of dollars, the big whales who come in and bet tens of thousands of dollars per hand. And they're requested by these whales because they know they're good dealers. So they take a lot of pride in their work. The cocktail servers take a lot of pride in their work and knowing when to cut somebody off when they've imbibed too much with alcohol. They know to look for warning signs. And when you have a full cocktail tray with seven drinks on it, and you're carrying it for 6 hours on the floor and weaving and bobbing through all of these customers, that tray weighs 20 pounds, and you're trying to make people happy. And it's hard work.
How are the health benefits today?
Today, one big difference is it depends on which job you're in. If you're in the restaurant and the hotel side of things, then you're covered. You're in the union, Local 54 of Unite here, which has been in the industry since before there were casinos. And they have pretty good health. They still have fought to maintain pretty good health benefits, although, like everyone, deductibles are going up and so forth. It's harder for people in the dealing positions, particularly the part-timers. There's such a shift towards hiring part-timers, and those people do not get benefits. So they're really dependent on things like the health care exchanges in order to keep their health care.
In the early days, part-timers did get benefits.
Yes.
Yes.
So the money slowly over the past decades has been leaving Atlantic City.
Absolutely. We've seen more cost-cutting. Essentially, we say we have to keep in mind that this is an industry that has gone from being mom-and-pop type operations run by, colorful entrepreneurs where people knew their managers and their managers treated them with dignity, into a situation in which the New Jersey's tight regulatory structure made this industry safe for Wall Street. Originally, big entertainment companies like Hilton and then Wall Street. Now the companies themselves are commodities that are bought and sold. And so people feel like there's bean counters in some distant place, like in this opening story that we talked about, who are leaning on their managers to cut costs, cut costs, cut costs. And that's led to a deterioration of the jobs. And that's been very bad for the city and the area around it.
And sometimes now you can't even point to a large company, a large entertainment company, because they're owned by hedge funds and private equity.
All right. Our guests are Deb Feigert and Ellen Mutari. They've co-authored the book, Just One More Hand, Life in the Casino Economy. If you'd like to send us an email, it's radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscoane. Back in just a moment. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscoane. Deb Feigert and Ella Mutari are professors of economics at Stockton University. They've written a book called Just One More Hand, Life in the Casino Economy. And they've interviewed 35 people from all walks of life who've worked or still work in Atlantic City's casinos, as that city has undergone many changes over the last decades. This hour, we're hearing some of their stories and looking at the health of the casino industry as a whole. If you'd like to touch base, if you've got any thoughts or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And before we went into break, we were talking about the jobs, a lot of the positive aspects, especially in the early days, the good wages, the benefits. You don't have to have a college education, and the tips. I mean, we didn't mention, I guess, when a whale, which is the word they use for a high roller, tipped a cocktail waitress, she might see how much, Ellen, on her tray?
Well, there was one woman named Ruth who talked about the time that somebody put, what was it, 6 purple chips in her hand, and that was a $3,000 chip. Oh, she went running to the bathroom.
It was a $3,000 tip.
What did I say? $3,000 tip.
Yes. $500 chips.
Yes.
This is what they relied on, though, because mm-hmm. the actual wage is pretty low.
Yeah, the base wage is pretty low. It's governed by minimum wage law, except if you're a union employee, then it's higher than that in Local 54. And the base wage of dealers is a little bit higher. It's about $4,
one
$5 an hour.
Employees said about they were up to $10 an hour. A lot of them are at 7 and 8, but the new part-time dealers are being hired at $4 an hour.
Okay.
So it's a sub-minimum wage.
This is a unique industry, obviously. I mean, gambling. You get mm-hmm. into the groove. If you're losing, the people who are working with you in the casinos have to deal with the fact that, you know, people get upset. Well, mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about that, what they have to deal with.
Well, our workers told us that it's the smoking and drinking that changes everything. If there mm-hmm. were a smoker or a drinker, a drunk in a regular workplace in particular, they would be tossed out. Because you have to learn how to handle that. You have to learn how to handle people blowing smoke in your face or throwing a drink at you or even worse.
Really?
Yes, or even worse, spitting at you. Mm. Or the slot technicians or slot attendants have to deal with people who refuse to leave a machine because they have to go to the bathroom, so they urinate right in their seat because they think the machine is going to hit any second.
Oh, you're kidding.
A pit boss told us that one of his good buddies had a heart attack on the floor, and the EMTs were called in, and the EMTs had to work on a guy near a slot machine, and the folks who were betting on the machine refused to leave the machine. What do you mean I have to leave? What do you mean I can't just step over this person who the EMTs are working on? And unfortunately, that worker was lost that day. So it's an industry with a lot of worker stories that are similar to the stories in today's American economy about good jobs going bad, but it's also a unique industry because gambling is so addictive.
And I have to say, the first couple of times in interviews where somebody mentioned the idea of somebody urinating or defecating on the casino floor, I thought, oh, that's one of those urban legends. You know, who knows, maybe it happened once or twice. So we actually started probing people, and they would swear, yes, I see this. I've seen this often. It happens all the time. We have to, you know, we have to change the seat covering on the chair. We have to bring in sanitation. And
so at what point is a gambler ejected?
That's tough. And I think that as profit margins are squeezed, people are expected to put up with more and more bad behavior. Another ways in which we've seen an increase in what you might call bad behavior has to do with the sexualization of the industry, too. New Jersey, Atlantic City, didn't have the reputation that Las Vegas does. We haven't had chorus girls for years and so forth. Of course, cocktail servers always wore somewhat revealing outfits. But as one Ruth, the woman who got the $3,000 tip, once said, they weren't like today's sleazy type costumes. So one thing we've seen is with the trying to make the casinos appeal more to upscale customers. That seems to have gone hand to hand with an increased emphasis on merchandising female servers' bodies or entertainment dealers in skimpy costumes. And with that seems to have come an increase in sexual harassment on the job.
So let's talk about how the women who are involved, who are working, handle this. What are you expected to take, and at what point do you complain, and is anybody hearing your complaints?
Deb? You're expected to take a lot, and this is not
such as what
you're not it well you're expected to take people touching your shoulder or gently brushing against your chest or maybe looking up your skirt. We heard lots of stories about employees being asked to bend down and pick something up while people were looking up their skirts. It takes a lot to be ejected from a casino. Here's something that surprised us, though. We asked questions about the cameras everywhere, the so-called eyes in the sky. We thought that employees who were monitored that carefully, that closely, and of course, dealers have to show their hands at all time. You can't rub your nose, you can't scratch your head, you can't scratch your back. You always have to clear your hands, clear your hands, clear your hands. One dealer told us she clears her hands at the Thanksgiving table.
What is clearing your hands involve?
You're showing your hands at all time, but if you accidentally touched your ear or behind your ear to adjust your glasses, you have to immediately hold your hands up, like hold, don't shoot, and clap your hands very, very lightly, and then hold them up again before you return to the cards.
Okay.
So we were asking about these eyes in the sky, and thanks to the eyes in the sky, somebody can get rejected for cheating or for really bad behavior. We thought employees would be concerned about being constantly monitored, as they are in other workplaces. But what we found was that the employees were glad the eyes in the sky were there, because they can say, go back and check the tape. Go back and check the digital tape. You bet too late in roulette. Or, no, you placed your chip down too late when I was dealing. Or, you did this to me. You touched me inappropriately, which you very rarely report, but at some point it gets really bad and you have to report it.
It sounds like if you want to keep your job there as a woman, you have to accept a certain amount of that.
We spoke with Lily, who was a younger cocktail server who really got fed up with it and left. We spoke with two older cocktail servers who'd been there a long time and felt like they didn't feel like they got harassed that often. And when they did, they got backed up and it was okay. But Lily worked at a bottle club. Which means it was an upscale club where patrons spend a lot of money to buy entire bottles of liquor. And she felt that she reported a lot of people who tried to touch her. She was expected, if somebody spent a lot of money, to be able to dance for her clients and on a raised pedestal so that they could enjoy watching their server dance. And she said sometimes people got fresh with her and touched her inappropriately, and she would get them kicked out. She alleges, that one of her managers told her, you know, you get the most people kicked out of anybody of any of your coworkers. And she interpreted it as saying, you know, why don't you just loosen up? Why don't you take more of this?
Mm-hmm. But it happens in Vegas, too. It happens in a lot of the experiences of selling entertainment. You are expected to endure so much that other employees are not.
Okay. We have a Facebook comment from Jay on a completely different line of thinking here. When gambling was first legalized in AC back in the day, the promise was New Jersey property taxes would go down. Fast forward to today, our property taxes are the highest in the nation. You're nodding your head, Deb.
Yes, there were three promises when gambling was voted into Atlantic City by referendum. One was a lower property taxes and higher state revenues. One was good jobs at good wages, and the third was local redevelopment. Let's use the money for local redevelopment. What has evolved over the years is the casinos didn't keep up their properties. So CRETA, the Casino Redevelopment Corporation, started spending money to help the casinos themselves rather than the community around the casinos. So there wasn't any money to lower property taxes. There wasn't an overflow of money beyond the casinos in the boardwalk. Why is that? Because the casinos built boxes on the sand. Boxes on the boardwalk. No windows, no clocks. The message was, don't go out there, don't go out there. So there wasn't that positive spillover effect of money being spent and circulated in the local community. So it made it very difficult for property taxes to go down, for local businesses to develop and redevelop and thrive. It was all about the boxes.
two brief things. One is, if you think about, a lot of times when you go check into a motel or hotel, you see lots of brochures in the lobby about other things to do in the area. You don't see that in casinos. You don't see brochures saying, oh, you can go to the Atlantic City Aquarium, or you can, here's an historic museum that you could go to. They're not encouraging you to take advantage of the community or go to the other restaurants or outside the casino and so forth. But the other thing has to do with property taxes. Property taxes are local, and a lot of the gaming taxes, the gross gaming revenue taxes, went to the state, not to the local government. And in fact, right now, recently, we've seen the casinos, because their income is down, going to Atlantic City and repealing the property taxes that they've been paying, and getting, they're putting further pressure on the local government to, that's hurting both Atlantic City and the county.
And because so many taxes are going to the states, other states in the Northeast and across this country are themselves becoming a little bit addicted to the taxes that are coming from gaming, because income taxes, so you can't raise income taxes to support public service. You can't raise corporate taxes to support public service. This is the mindset of some folks. Therefore, we have to tax where it's easy, and taxing gaming is one of the easiest taxes to collect. It's a sin tax.
Over a third of the population lives below the poverty line in Atlantic City, according to the U.S. Census. Do you need to somehow help those who live in poverty first before Atlantic City can truly diversify and enjoy a renaissance?
I think that that's very important, that the problem is how to do that. And we do see that creating good jobs is the cornerstone of how we go about turning around Atlantic City and the surrounding communities. Now, one argument that's always been made is that part of the problem has been that when people did have good jobs in the casinos, they moved out of the city. But that's not entirely true. We met a lot of people who had jobs in the casinos who also worked in the city. And so it's hard to know how we go about turning around the high poverty levels. But clearly good jobs with good wages, it has to be a cornerstone, because it's wages that tend to circulate in a local economy. As economists, we know this. Profits can, particularly in this global gaming era, can go anywhere. They can be invested in new properties somewhere else. But when people have good jobs, they tend to spend it in their local communities. And so having good jobs is critical. But looking for one magic bullet, whether it's online gaming or sports betting or a new college being built or any one thing.
Or a new resort like Revel that turned out to be a failure, that was supposed to be the game changer and the savior.
Mm-hmm. How could the people who put that into play have been so wrong?
I think that people get big dreams, and they get caught up with their little projects and their visions of what they think will appeal to people. But also we have to say that Borgata, which opened in 2003, became the market leader in Atlantic City by appealing to upscale customers. And one thing that we found from the people we spoke with is that in general, other than the person who had to serve in the bottle club, employees thought that they had done it relatively the right way, that they treated their employees well, the food was even better in the cafeteria, and then they had happy employees who were catered well to upscale customers. So Revel was designed to amplify that, but obviously they put much too much money into it. The timing was bad.
This might sound like an out of left field question here, but Revel from the start, at least at the beginning, was smoke-free. And considering that smoking is such a part of the gambling culture, did that cripple Revel from the start?
Well, it could have, but how many upscale customers can you sustain in a country that has seen a decline in the middle class over the last 25 or 30 years? Revel was supposed to be the resort at the end of the boardwalk that would draw in all of the best upscale customers, perhaps siphoning some of them off from the Borgata and perhaps bringing them in by air or by car from other places and maybe even from Asia. But the more resorts you build, the more crowded the market becomes, the more you wind up just shrinking the pie and fighting over what's left. And Revel, as one magic bullet, could not possibly sustain that.
And it sits dark today.
And it sits dark without power.
Let's get an email from Brian in before the break. What about the Governor Byrne promise that casino taxes would go to the elderly and disabled? Was there a fund created, and what happened to it?
We didn't track how the money entirely got spent. So I'm afraid that I don't have a great answer for Brian about the details of that. My understanding is that technically the law has been followed, but that in a sense the casinos wound up, the casino revenue in some ways got commingled with other kinds of state ventures. You can designate the money towards one particular function, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't supplant money that would have gone to those functions anyway.
Sure. You mentioned internet gambling a moment or so ago, mm-hmm. Which apparently helped with the increase in profit in March. Do you see the internet as something of a savior or as an eventual Achilles heel for the brick and mortar?
Well, we were just talking about how many resorts can you have? And I use a sports analogy that not every casino can be the New York Yankees that has a national market. So eventually, the customers you get come from a smaller and smaller ring around your property. Well, the story of building a grand resort vis-a-vis the story of internet gaming where you can do it at home in your pajamas, what kind of consistent message does that bring to the industry? Either you're going to have resorts or you're going to have gambling at home or possibly both. What are you trying to go for? What's your brand there? So this is what the industry is struggling with right now.
And it seems to us to be part of a long-term trend towards the normalization of gambling. One of the things that's hurt Atlantic City and other casino destination resorts is that it's not exciting to go to a casino anymore because they're everywhere. So it used to be something that special that you did, and you went on vacation to go to a casino. But now, since so many people on the East Coast live within a half an hour of a casino, it's not worth going on vacation. Once you start having internet gaming where people, as Deb said, can do it in their pajamas, who's going to pick up and go to a casino? And it's certainly not going to be something exciting to do. So casinos and gambling have become a normal part of our existence.
And it hasn't been easy getting internet gaming off the ground anyway. Number of banks won't allow their credit cards to be used in setting up gambling accounts, which is understandable.
Mm-hmm. But in the old days, Wall Street shied away from the casinos. So I think that is coming. And one possible rosy scenario here is they thought Netflix would destroy the entertainment industry. And it's actually made the entertainment industry better. It's made television richer. It's made movies richer.
All right. We're up against a break. Deb Figart and Ella Mutari have co-authored the book, Just One More Hand, Life in the Casino Economy. We'll hear more stories from the book in just a moment. If you'd like to give us a call, it's 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Deb Figart and Ella Mutari are professors of economics at Stockton University. And they've written a book called Just One More Hand, Life in the Casino Economy. Lines are open if you'd like to give us a call. If you've worked in the casinos, if you still work there, if you've visited the casinos, we'd love to hear what you think at 888-477-9499. The job of guest room attendant or mm-hmm. cleaning person, not a glamorous job, but one of the more stable and even family-friendly jobs in the economy.
Yes, that was very interesting because we spoke with several guest room attendants. They like that term or housekeeper, but they do not like to be called maids. And several of them were well-educated in their original home countries. We spoke to people from India, from Latin America, because it does tend to be a job that...
It's a gateway.
A gateway job for a lot of immigrants. And some of them had actually been teachers in their home countries. But when they came to the U.S., they wound up in Atlantic City being attracted by jobs. And they found that because the job was 9 to 3, essentially, during the day, They could do that and get home in time to be there home from school when their kids came home from school. So even though some of them had thought initially, oh, I'm going to move over and eventually become a dealer, dealers, as Deb said, have to work, start off at least, on some of the hardest shifts at night. So they found that they kind of liked it in some ways. And what's interesting is because gamblers do tend to go back to the same casinos, and they are superstitious. They often go back to the same floor of the hotel all the time, and they will actually bond with the guest room attendants. So even guest room attendants made friends with their regular customers, exchanged birthday cards, went to family events, and that was something that seemed surprising.
And yet even in this industry, you find with the guest room attendant, they might find stresses that might not be in other service sector industries.
Yes. So one of them that we spoke with said, you never know what you're going to see when you open the door, essentially. And so, you know, everything from, you know, people making out on the bed while you're cleaning the bathroom and you come out and find them naked, to finding bodies, in the rooms, which was very sad. And they said, usually it wasn't suicide, although there is suicide from problem gamblers, but also just elderly people who drank too much and kind of taxed their bodies too much would just kind of expire in the room. So that was very stressful. It's also physically very difficult work. You're making beds over and over again. You're dealing with chemicals in the cleaning equipment. One woman who became active in the union, Local 54 of Unite Here, did so in part because she was the person who kept trying to fight to make sure that the workers had gloves to use when they were cleaning with the harsh chemicals.
Has that job remained relatively stable in terms of wage and benefits from the beginning in the late 70s to 2015?
Relatively, yes. But what we have seen in some casinos, not all casinos, is a reorganization of the work in an attempt to streamline it and make it more efficient. So whereas one person we spoke with still had her own area and her regular customers, and she loved her job. She said, you know, every day she goes to work and tries to think how she's going to make someone's life better. Someone else we spoke with said that essentially in order to make sure that they got the requisite number of rooms done in a day, they would get shifted from moment to moment to do two rooms on this floor and then go to this other wing in this other tower and do a room here. And it would be different every day. So they lost their contact with regular customers, which made the job much less enriching.
In some casinos, you know who also lost their contact with regular customers? And this is very important. Cocktail servers. Some casinos have reorganized
the
work.
Same casinos.
So they've reorganized the work so that you didn't have your area where you served your customer your usual drink. You knew how many they had. You knew when to cut them off. They reorganized it so that you went to the bar and the bartender made the next seven drinks, and you delivered them anywhere on the casino floor, wherever the customer ordered them on their iPad or iPad mini, and you were ping-ponging around the casino floor, and you were timed, and you only had something like 7 minutes to deliver those seven drinks.
So today, then, is it harder to flag somebody who's inebriated?
Yes, indeed.
You also write of the challenge that many who work in the casino industry have of developing relationships with the people who come in to gamble. But they suffer because it's hard to tell somebody who is losing and who's losing everything to stop. Are they allowed to do that? It sounds like they walk a line. They don't always do it. They want to.
They do have to walk a careful line. And we heard some wonderful stories from a waiter whose name was Walter, or his pseudonym was Walter. And Walter talked a lot about we asked people, what made you most proud on your job? And we got very interesting variety of answers about that. And what Walter said is he actually felt the most pride when he would tell somebody, you need to go home now. And he told stories about somebody who would start coming in with $30 comps, which meant they had gambled a lot. And then they'd be coming in with $20 comps. And then they'd be coming in with $10 comps. Comps are the rewards you get when you gamble a certain amount. And he could tell that they were bleeding their their funds in order to keep gambling, or they would be there overnight. He'd go home after a shift. He'd come back the next day and find the person in the same clothes. And he saw himself as their family member because he had fed them and served them and felt like occasionally he'd been able to say to someone, hey, you know, don't you think you've been here long enough? Don't you think you ought to go home? I've been home, showered, slept, came back, and you're still here.
Mm. And that's an important relationship that you develop with your customers, that face-to-face relationship, that delicate line where the dealer says you might want to move on, or I mean, when you sit at the table, you got to deal to them. But it is that fine line. That face-to-face relationship does not exist with internet gaming.
One more question before we get to the phones. It seems almost seems quaint, but in the effort to win approval for gambling from Jersey voters back in the 70s, you write that there was great trepidation about the social costs of gambling. Now the gambling seemingly is ubiquitous. Was there reason for caution?
There are many more studies about that, and that was really not the focus of our book, to weigh those. I think there's a mixed record. I don't think that there's some of the crime concerns that people thought. But certainly the addictiveness of gaming is a problem, and I think, you know, it raises questions.
Well, that does take its toll on these wonderful workers that are trying very hard to have pride in their work in the industry. They have shared with us that sometimes they go home and they say to themselves, this is what I do for a living. And that's why some of them walk away, ultimately.
Okay, let's get to the phones. Kumar in Nicetown, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question. In recent years, Las Vegas kind of went towards having family-based entertainment. So, like, when the parents would go to the casino, you know, they had their kids were able to, you know, go to the pools or like a local amusement park that's there. Did Atlantic City even think of the idea of doing something like that? And if they did, what happened? And if they didn't, why haven't they thought about it?
That's an excellent question. And Atlantic City has always had family-based entertainment. It was a sure community for families and their summer homes and family vacations long before casinos ever got there. Now, you have to be 21 to enter a casino, so it's a good question about family-based entertainment. And the city and city planners and entrepreneurs and community members are trying to redevelop the city. The city has been down before, and the city will come back again. And it's not for the lack of trying. There's Steel Pier and rides and entertainment. Is it a little too late? Perhaps. But it's not that the city isn't thinking about family entertainment and the arts and music and culture and wonderful playgrounds and things
shopping.
For kids. Shopping.
Shopping, yes.
Yeah, the Bass Pro Shop opened last week, and I guess it was mobbed.
Apparently. And there were, even before the Bass Pro Shops, they have a huge set of outlets there, which has been great because it's something that both the local community can use as well as attracting tourists.
Okay, Kumar, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Valerie, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome.
Hello, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, sure.
I was listening at your program, and one of them struck me. I am a casino worker at the Sugar House Casino, and I'm wondering why Philadelphia don't have the good-paying jobs like Atlantic City. I work as a CVS attendant, and I'm also on the organizing committee to get a union there. And some of the things you described is exactly what's going on in my casino.
Thanks, Valerie, for the call. Ellen?
Well, I have two answers. One is that the jobs in Atlantic City are not as good as they used to be, first of all. And that's partly because the industry has more competition, and that's been taken out of the hide of the workers in order to keep costs down. So that's the first thing. But secondly, I think it's great that you folks are working on organizing a union there. We did have the benefit for the hotel and restaurant workers of having Local 54 of Unite here. And that has helped protect a lot of the workers in those jobs, non-casino jobs, from the deteriorating conditions. We've also seen the United Auto Workers organize in a handful, the dealers, and a couple of other job categories in a couple of the casinos in Atlantic City. And that has helped. We spoke with a woman named Laurel who really felt that a lot of the older, higher paid dealers were being pressured and monitored very carefully. And so if they had even the slightest thing wrong, there was pressure on them so they could get rid of them. Mm. And she felt that having a union grievance procedure was really helping protect her job because she felt they were trying to squeeze her out.
So it does help those who are being aged out.
Yes. Okay. It does.
Got a Facebook comment from Zach. I think I'm being scolded here. Not one mention of scandal when speaking of Revel. Why has Governor Christie received such a pass on this $2.4 billion mistake that was bankrupt almost as soon as it opened?
We do talk about that. We actually have a large section of a chapter about the tax breaks and bailouts and subsidies. There's an organization called Good Jobs First that's worked with a New Jersey group called New Jersey Policy Perspectives that have focused a lot on the surge in subsidies under the Christie administration. Governor Christie has been very good to large corporations in New Jersey. So rather than being a small government type of conservative, in many ways he's been a big government type of conservative. We talk a lot about how in many ways the debate in our society these days is not really between big and small government. It's about whose interests government is going to serve. And under the Christie administration, they did channel a lot of both subsidies and tax breaks in order to build this building that we put $2.4 billion mm-hmm. into, that's now sitting as an empty shell gathering mold because we can't even get electricity to it.
Thanks so much for that Facebook comment. Speaking of Governor Christie, let's just touch briefly on Hurricane Sandy. Mm-hmm. Casinos were closed for days. They lost $5 million a day mm-hmm. collectively. Was Sandy a catalyst for further decline?
Well, the decline happened long before that with the Great Recession. The Great Recession and also the declining middle class helped feed the decline before that. But the PR from that the closing was bad. And it's not good to have casinos closed for a few days and not good to have an East Coast storm with all of that damage.
Yeah, I think people were concerned. They saw some of the devastation further up north in New Jersey and assumed that Atlantic City was equally in such bad shape, but it wasn't.
But there was more forgiveness with Superstorm Sandy than the closing a few summers earlier when the state couldn't pass its budget by July 1st.
Yeah.
And that's when the regulators couldn't be on the floor, and therefore the casinos were closed for something like 3 days. There was more ire about that closure from politicians than from Superstorm Sandy, which is Mother Nature.
But really, Deb is right that the problems in Atlantic City, the financial storm hit us more, in a sense, than the actual Mother Nature storm. There were a lot of plans in the around 2004, 2005, 2006, to bring in new resorts. And resorts would have, as the other caller mentioned, family resorts, family attractions, other kinds of things, non-gaming attractions. And essentially, with the financial crisis, all of the financing for that dried up. And most of those projects went away. Revel was the only one that emerged out of that, and it wound up being a failure.
So I've read that Bally's might be on the bubble. Where do you see Atlantic City in the next 5 years? Is it going to lose more casinos, do you think?
I don't know for sure, and I'm certainly not going to encourage that by speculating on that. Somebody told me recently that they remembered in the initial campaigns to build casinos that people said that they had seen a study that said 8 is the perfect number, and 8 is what we have right now. So knock on wood, we certainly hope there aren't more closures. I think one of the big issues forthcoming for Atlantic City is what's going on with the threatened closing of Taj, the Trump Taj Mahal, and the main stakeholder in that is Carl Icahn. And he seems to be determined to break the union, which is one of the few sources of bargaining power that workers have in this competitive industry. So I think that that is going to determine whether or not for those people who are trying to hold on in the industry, whether or not they're going to be able to.
All right, stay tuned. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Deb Feigart and Ellen Mutari, thank you so much for joining us for
this
hour of Radio
Times.
Thank you so much. It was enjoyable. The book is Just One More Hand, Life in the Casino Economy. Don't forget, you can visit our Facebook page and check out our podcast by heading to our homepage, whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. Hour 2 is coming up next.